Cool. Call to order of Highlight Rural Fire District. Reminder to the public that meetings are being recorded. Is there any public comment on matters not included in the agenda? Seeing as none, Highlight Rural Consent Agenda. Does anything need to be pulled from the consent agenda? Seeing as none.
Motion to approve consent agenda as presented.
Do I have a second?
Second.
Do I have a...
Walt.
What did you want me to say?
Oh, if there's any public
comment. Is there any public comment on the motion? Seeing as none.
Walt.
Aye.
Yes.
Ken.
Yes.
Justin.
Yes. All right, regular agenda, discussion and decision on adding mileage to ambulance billing.
So I don't know if you guys actually have anything in the packet, but basically what this is, so if you remember back, December of 2021 is when we adopted our ambulance rate for billing. So currently for an in-district resident on a basic life support call, we're billing a flat rate of $450. Non-resident basic life support call, we're billing a flat rate of $750. Now, when we adopted those rates, if you remember back, the $750 was mid-range for the state for BLS transport. The $450 was the break we gave our taxpayers already at kind of the threshold that Medicaid, Medicare paid for a BLS transport. Pintler kind of just let us know and why we brought it onto the agenda. You know, when we talked about billings or billing rates, you know, we talked about not leaving money on the table. And Pintler let us know that we're not, with that flat rate, we didn't figure in charging for mileage, which Medicaid and Medicare pay for. So we just were going to bring it up to you guys to consider. We could start billing for mileage. So Medicare will reimburse $8.80 per mile for a transport.
Is that on top of these?
That would be on top of this. So we'd have our flat rate, $450, $750, and then we could charge an additional $8.80 per mile. And just to give you guys an idea, so a transport, so mileage from Sourdough Station to the hospital is 4.6 miles. Cottonwood Station to the hospital is 10 miles. Ray Station to the hospital is 7.1 miles. So roughly, depending on where the transport was coming from, if it was coming out by Cottonwood, we'd get $88. If it was around here, we're looking at like $40. Over by Ray Station would be $60 to $70. And that's per transport. On average, it's been fluctuating a little bit, but 5 to 6 transports a month, that would help a little bit. I mean, especially, and the biggest thing I figured I'd bring it to you guys is it is money that we're not collecting from Medicare, which is kind of guaranteed payment, so.
Yeah. And so that wouldn't be coming out, so in a resident case, just to be clear, that would not be coming out of the resident's pocket, that would be coming out of the Medicare, Medicaid reimbursement then.
Right.
Just for clarity.
Yeah.
And would we ever do mutual aid to Big Sky or, you know, grabbing someone in the canyon or,
you know,
going to Livingston if we had to? Or?
We're doing mutual aid outside the district. We've done several in the city of Bozeman. We've done them on the Bozeman Pass. I think that's, we might have done a couple at Central Valley already. So yeah, there's further out that billing for mileage would go further.
And it doesn't, it's not round trip, it's just from when we pick the patient.
Yep, loaded. It's just for the transport.
Yeah.
Loaded mile.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that leaving money on the table, I think that we should definitely add it, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree. I would think that would help. I don't know how the cost structure is going to shake out in terms of wear and tear on equipment and so on as we get into this a little bit deeper, look at it a little bit more. But if that's the case where there's really no harm to our residents and potentially, you know, defray some costs associated with the ambulance service. Right. I would agree that we should probably look at capture.
When we're talking about this, Brian, you mentioned that $450 is the Medicare, basically the cost. Is that something that we can set up so that Pentler will tell us yearly if they had an increase that we're also raising these rates?
Yeah, I mean, we annually renew the contract. So every year we renew a contract, we can ask them for a comparison of what they're paying out.
Yeah. And Pentler is more than they're willing to supply us with the data with regard to the state.
Yeah, they've been very forthcoming for anything we've asked for.
Yeah. Yeah, so we'll have pretty reliable data to make that decision on that.
Okay. And honestly, for what's going on with inflation, I mean, not the resident rate, but here in the near future, we might want to revisit that non-resident rate because everything's getting more expensive.
Yeah. Okay. Do I have a motion?
Yes.
Do I have any public comment on the motion?
Second.
Second?
Walt?
Aye.
Ken?
Yes.
Justin?
Yes. All right, number two, discussion and decision renewal of health insurance policy.
Well, you guys have the renewal there, so same provider, Blue Cross Blue Shield, through Mountain West? Right. First West.
First West.
So it roughly took a 9% increase on our premium. It's the same plan, nothing's changed. So no changes to benefit, it's just a 9.3% increase.
And just for information, I talked to all the staff and asked them if they were happy with their plan, if they want to switch their plan, and you know, the options were available for them to look at, same from last year.
Yeah.
And everyone seemed was pleased with their plan and didn't want to make any changes. So this the little bit of an increase in the renewal is with the exact same plans that they signed up for last year.
Yeah. Question on this, the fact that we give three plan options, but most people only take the one, does that affect our rates?
No.
No?
I don't believe so.
Okay. Because if we only had one, it would give us better rates because everybody would be on the same thing. So I didn't know. I know we're a smaller amount of people that we're having on there, but just curious. So, because everybody's taking the best. So it's,
Cool.
All right. Do I have a motion?
Motion to approve the insurance rate as presented.
Second.
Any public comment on the motion? Seeing as none.
Well.
Aye.
Ken.
Yes.
Justin.
Yes. Number three, fire chief's report.
All right. I'll try to run through this. Feels like I'm writing a novel sometimes these days, but so started off January with 57 incidents, and then I added, we were doing a 3-year. Past 3 years, I increased that to 5 just to show a little more variation of what the calls. Now, we're only a month in, so there's not much really to report there. It's pretty well on average. One thing, number two, I did add in something that I thought would be kind of helpful to track going forward is, so Chris and I have identified our kind of ideal staffing model on calls. And mainly as we go forward, as things get busier, and kind of our models that we're running with, so primarily volunteers supported by a paid staff now, just to give you guys an idea of, you know, how we're doing with that, hitting that ideal staffing model. So out of the 57 incidents in January, we properly staffed apparatus on 40 of those, which is a 70% of that call volume. A significant amount of the staffing issues occurred January 1 through January 14th, as I previously reported, during the winter break. then it kind of gives, with our national fire reporting system, gives you a breakdown. So of that 57, five of them were fires, which we did 4 out of 5 properly staffed. EMS, MVA, rescue, 25 out of 34. Hazardous condition without fire would be like kind of like natural gas calls, hazmat calls, those type of incidents. And that was 1 out of 3. Service calls, lift assists and such, was 1 out of 1. Good intent calls, so a good intent call would be like canceled while responding, or basically we didn't get on scene. That was 7 out of 12. Thing to consider with good intent calls is what those actually originated as, which in the National Fire Reporting System, they say good intent calls. So they might have been medical calls, they might have been fire calls, but we were canceled on the way to that call. And then false alarms was 2 out of 2. So 70%, we're still making it by, but I just wanted to kind of give the month-to-month report on what this looks like going forward, just so we have kind of an idea out of that. Our current roster sits still at 43, and then you can see the breakdown of membership there. We're down to 7 residents at Sourdough. Kylie Ventarosa moved out of the fire station. She's still an active member, and we're hoping to get some more in. We did lose 1 person at Cottonwood. We're down to 3, but it's only temporary, and it's due because of a military deployment. So Aaron Constantino is active duty in the Air Force, and he got deployed. It's short, though. It's only till June, so it's only a 6-month deployment. The Ray House, we've been struggling a bit. We're down to 2 renters there. As a result kind of all of this, so we recently ran through and did kind of a SWOT analysis of the department just to kind of get people's temperature on how they're feeling, things are going. And out of that, I kind of created a working group of just to review residents since we do have vacancies. It's the first time since really we opened Sourdough Station in 2014 that we've had vacancies. Up until this point, we've had actually a waiting list of people to get in. So one of the changes that I've implemented is at the Ray House, and it was something that was kind of recommended. Historically, so the Ray House, they pay rent, and it has been, rent has kind of shifted. I think it started at like $300 a month. We bumped it to $500, and recently we bumped it to $650 a month. And then there's been a 30% incentive where if they ran 30% of the calls in a month, they would only pay us $100 a month. And one of the kind of dislikes that people identified is if they made like 28 to 29%, which could be only a call off of 30%, they would still have to pay full price in rent, even though they were like 1 call short. So what I implemented was a prorated rent schedule, basically from 20%, and I actually bumped it up to 50%. Allowing them to get a break even if they can't make that full 30%. And it's still starting at 20%, which is a requirement for residency. It's still at $650 a month, and then you can see in that table, it adjusts up from there. And if they go beyond 30%, which some members do, not many do, they could get to basically not paying us rent if they made 50%. But that's a lot of activity for a member to do in a month. Non-residents are still doing the day shifts.
Real quick, the utility costs?
Yeah.
What has that been right now?
Total? For like a month on average? Oh, I don't actually
know. Because they're paying rent and a quarter of the utilities?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
I guess we have. Yeah. Cable TV and...
It's their gas, electric... they do pay sewer because the house is hooked to rainwater and sewer. And then their Wi-Fi and trash collection, I believe, are the ones there.
Could they get to the point where they're not even paying for utilities, or?
We could get there. I'd like to ride this for a while and just see how it goes, and see if we can spur up some interest off of this model.
The utility portion of their bill is usually, certainly not more than $50, closer around the $30, $34 range. $10, $11 for water.
Yeah.
20-some when it's split up between, and they're, especially during the summer, they're very conservative of their, you know, the utilities.
I see.
They don't want to pay.
Are there any maintenance items you need to do out there?
At the house?
Make it more...
We did talk about that in the working group, and I mean, it is an old house, but it's functional. I mean, it's not living in the new house. It's.
Do we ever get that mini split or anything put in there?
Yep.
They did that? Okay.
It got put in the end of the summer. I think like September is when it went in.
Nice.
So it does have air conditioning in it now.
Very nice.
So, I don't know. I mean, to me, the house is completely functional.
We upgraded it a little bit.
We did. We replaced carpeting. We replaced the shower this past year in one of the bathrooms. So anything that's like breaking, we're fixing. But I mean, it's still like wood paneling walls and kind of an older model house.
But it's hard to justify putting a lot of money into that at this point.
Given kind of what we've discussed about a station replacement over there, to do a whole bunch of remodeling, that house probably wouldn't financially make sense.
Right.
And the deck, is it functional now? I haven't been over there to look at it.
It's functional. I mean, that could be
safely
replaced.
Safely functional, or does it really need to?
I mean, I don't have a reason to believe it's unsafe, but it is old and a little rickety. I mean, I wouldn't put a whole party full of people out there, but for the number of people that live there.
Yeah, I wonder if that's something that maybe take a look at that and maybe sort of sister it up. Mm-hmm. You know, didn't rebuild the whole thing, just sister it up so structurally, you know, just improve that structure. Maybe sister up some four bys on it and a couple of joists or something.
Yep.
So going back to the whole picture, or do you want to finish up and then come back to this, or are you going to discuss?
We can discuss.
On the residence, so going back to Cottonwood Station, you have one, that opening, we don't have a waiting list. You said the waiting list kind of evaporated then?
Yep, so really everybody who's on the waiting list has moved into the system, so we currently don't have anybody waiting to come in.
And then the opening at the Cottonwood Station, that is 6 months then for the person who's to, and are we going to try and fill that with a temporary?
Ideally we would. We don't have anybody interested in it right now. We do have, so as they're on shift, so Cottonwood does weeknights, there are just non-residents going and spending the night there in that empty room, to at least get somebody in there at night. Mm-hmm. But yeah, ideally, Aaron did kind of clear his room out, and we're storing his stuff for him at the station while he's gone. But we just don't have anybody interested to take that spot right now.
And then when it's fully staffed, the Ray House, you've been putting four people?
Mm-hmm. Four people. Yeah.
So do we have, looking at the total number of volunteers, then are we getting a little bit shorter on volunteers, or still running roughly the same?
Our roster's doing good, so at 43, that's pretty average what we've been running. I mean, we do need to continue doing our recruitment. And just today, Chris and I talked about maybe trying to do a class of 8 this spring. Mm-hmm. I think we're up to roughly 20 applications for the spring. Mm-hmm. And generally we take 6. We can't take 8. If we go beyond 8, it just slows the process down a lot with the amount of coaching help we have. So we do need to, one thing we identified in the working group also is just kind of pushing a little more education of what, there seems to be a little bit of a perception that people in the resident program just do a lot of work. And I don't know that from an outside view that people truly understand kind of what the requirements are. So Chris, Mike, and myself are going to start to build in some education points, even from the informational meeting that we start with bringing on a new class at the end of the class, kind of reiterating the points of what the requirements for residency are, so people are a little more aware of what we're actually, our expectations are. Because mm-hmm. I think in the past, we still do, I mean, our residents do a lot. I mean, 30 to 40% of the call volume in a month. And I think there's just kind of been a perception built that that is like a requirement, which it necessarily isn't. We encourage people to come on as many calls as they can. And it may come to a point where we need to look at just advertising differently if we can't keep the, because currently we don't advertise live-in options at all. It's something we tell people after the fact that they come in. You know, for reasoning why people aren't taking advantage of the system, of the opportunity now, there's different factors. I mean, it's something we went through and looked at in our SWOT analysis. Some of it is people have pets, which we don't allow on the stations, dogs and such. And some people, they just don't, it's not worth them to save the money to have to live at the fire station. So that's kind of what we're dealing with now. But yeah, our hope is, I mean, we're sitting at 43. You know, if we can bring in a solid 8, you know, that'll bump us back around to that 50 number. I mean, we did just have a lot of turnover in the last year also, which is a slight factor of it. You know, a lot of our people, not a lot of our people, but some key people who were living at the fire stations moved on for new opportunities and either their careers, the fire service, whatever it happened to be. So we're in a little bit of a recovery stage from that also.
Yeah, historically, when we started the resident program, I mean, we pretty much had a waiting list from the beginning, nearly.
Roughly. I mean, when we first started the first year or two, we were able to fill it. And then after that first year or two, yeah, there was on average 3 to 4 waiting to come into the system. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting that there isn't more with the price of housing and stuff.
Yeah.
More interest.
And hopefully we can fix that in the future. I mean, we've talked even about, like, you know, as we go through the interviewing process, so we have 20 applications, we'll select 8 of those, giving preference points to people who express interest in living in at the fire station. So there's different options we can look at. Non-residents, they're still doing their day shifts. That number even is currently a little bit low, so there's 10 shifts we need filled during the week. Currently we're filling 6 of them. 3 of our non-resident firefighters are doing shifts on the weekends because they work during the week and they don't have that time available. So again, hopefully with some recruitment ongoing, one thing we've identified as, you know, a potential problem is 22 and 21, both spring classes were light on people. I think we recruited 4 people per spring class, and that could be a little bit of the kind of situation we're in right now is we weren't bringing in that ideal number of people. So number 8, we're starting to face a little bit of a challenge with our command staffing. Our goal, so we want a command officer on duty 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Currently, our paid staff is covering days, 7 days a week, which leaves volunteer captains for night shifts, 7 days a week. So if you do the math on that, that really means that we ideally need to maintain 7 volunteer captains. We are currently sitting at 5, with 4 in reserve. And reserves are essentially kind of help when you can. Jason Ravisky, who retired as the fire chief, he's now a reserve captain, so he's kind of helping when he can. As we kind of go through 23, we predict we're going to lose three of those five throughout the year. Where we are in the process of promoting up another three. Unfortunately, one of which of that three we know we're going to lose over the summer to a summer job. So it's getting a little tougher. Again, we had a lot of turnover in 22 of people leaving for opportunity. You know, fortunately, people aren't leaving because they're unhappy or they're, you know, they don't want to be part of the fire department. They're leaving because they're going on to a job that they went to school for, or they're getting hired by a career fire department. So really did I bring it to your guys' attention just to say Chris and I are just exploring different options of what may be fixes of that going into the future. We had set kind of a goal to promote at least five captains a year. One thing we don't want to necessarily get into is pushing people too hard before they're actually ready for that. Because that captain position is it's a stressful, important position running incident command. And we don't want to necessarily be forcing people into that before they're ready for that. I think that's the doom and gloom of my report. Regular training, still going, multi-company training every Wednesday, command training twice a month. We did recently, at the end of January, we hosted a mutual aid training for command. We had Gallatin Gateway out, the 911 center sent a dispatcher, Fort Ellis sent a few people. All of our auto aid partners were invited. And again, those trainings, we're doing them every other month where we're sending out outside invitations, and they just continue to be a really good thing for our people. To be able to just identify some differences, that kind of stuff. We had several members, I won't necessarily name them all, you can see them there on number 11, that attended an expanding incident training focused on wildfire incidents in the county. That was recently, February 9th. I was one of the instructors for it, and it really focused on an expanding wildland fire, so fire that's not going to go out that first day, and kind of how, as a county, we deal with that. Myself, Captain Malone, Captain Prado, and Lieutenant Templeton attended an initial incident commander class recently in February, and that was IC for wildland fires. Mac is well into preparing for our 23 Spring Academy. Like I said, we roughly have 20 applications. We are running a social media recruitment campaign. We haven't done that in the past, so we're doing a paid advertisement on Instagram and Facebook to basically push some information. So hopefully we'll see what that comes up with. We've already done one community involvement fair at MSU, and we have another one coming up in March. And then that Spring Academy will be starting here in March after spring break. We had a structure fire in Covered Wagon on January 22nd. Everything went well. I had mutual aid for that. Number 15, what we just talked about. So three times in the month of January, we were requested for mutual aid ambulance transports out of the district. I continue to chair the Gallatin County Fire Council Communication Committee, as well as Dahlhauser still doing the training committee. Dahlhauser has been working on a committee made up of fire, law enforcement, and DES on developing the Gallatin County Rescue Task Force model. And giving you guys kind of an overview, that's the training we did in Sacagawea. Back this fall of an active killer and going in and rescuing patients with law enforcement. So Chris has been really helping the county move that forward. Number 18, we're in the process. So I'm going to apply for a Homeland Security grant to actually get our rescue task force equipment purchased. So that's basically ballistics vests and helmets that are required to be a part of that rescue task force model. Myself and Dahlhauser have been working a lot recently. So Gallatin County has contracted with a company called Kramer and Associates to review the EMS system as a whole in Gallatin County. And it's a consultant, so their goal, or our goal is, once this is done, they'll give us recommendations of how we can improve EMS in the county as a whole. It's, as you guys know, it's very fragmented currently between what Central Valley does, what AMR does. There's Three Forks Ambulance, there's now what we're doing, there's Big Sky. So it's just kind of an effort to make recommendations to streamline that process a little bit better. That should be wrapping up this spring. Ambulance transporting, again, it's up and running. We should be seeing our revenues coming in. Chris has been working with Pendler a lot, and they've gotten everything, I believe, up to date as far as billing going out. So that revenue should start hopefully coming in as that billing process works through. We haven't had any firefighter injuries, thankfully, in January. As far as apparatus out of service, engine 6, we did have a failure of the EGR valve on that truck, and it was out of service for 7 days because of that. Prado did work with Best Straight Diesel on tearing into that further, and they basically found that the EGR valve had very, very highly overheated, and they kind of said it was probably because of when it had gasoline ran through it. So we notified Story Distributing of that issue, and it was roughly a $7,000 repair, $6,000 to $7,000 repair, and Story Distributing did pay for that. So that is back into service. We had Ambulance 62 out of service for a couple of days with an electrical issue that Colin was able to fix. Number 23, Colin's been working with Best Rate for the past couple of years, really since he started working here, on kind of working with their mechanics on what our trucks are looking like as they're coming through Best Rate for their services. And based off of that information, we've basically are gonna adjust our maintenance schedule of our trucks a little bit to get it more in line of what the manufacturer's recommendations were. And you know, they've been looking at what fluids are looking like when they're coming out of the trucks, what the wear and tear is on the trucks. And basically what the recommendations from Best Rate is we could probably extend that out a little bit. Like when they're dropping gear oil and stuff, it's practically looking brand new on some of the trucks. So
do we ever send it out to a lab for analysis?
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good question.
I don't believe we have in the past.
Yeah, I think that would be something that should be looked into maybe.
Yeah, we can.
Some of those fluids, yeah, just to have lab analysis done before they drop them. I don't know what the cost is relative to the change mm-hmm. out, but you know, once we get up to that timeline for what the recommended change, maybe do a lab analysis and
yeah.
see if it's, we can go a little bit further.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can definitely look into that.
They analyze it and tell you what's in there, and you know, like on your transmission, they say you've got a disc is failing or something, you know, and there's too much. But yeah, so sometimes it does preventative things. It finds things that are about to go out.
Right.
And and I don't think it's too terribly expensive, and I'm sure that it's stuff that you would drop in a box and UPS out to somebody.
Mm.
You know, they send you the jars and you
yep.
take some oil out and send it in.
Yeah, all the big mines with all their equipment, they all do that sort of thing. Yeah, I'm sure there's several companies doing that work now.
Yeah, okay. We'll definitely look into it. What we're looking at is, so every truck goes in for kind of an annual maintenance right now, which drops every fluid, changes it, DOT inspection on the truck. Colin has a whole list of things if you guys want to see it. I can bring it in to you next month. But when that goes in, the charge for that truck running through all that is up to like $4,000 per truck. And if we find that, you know, we could extend the life of some of that stuff, it would do some significant cost savings for us. We're still I mean, technically we're exempt from DOT inspection, but I think it's just a good insurance policy to have a third party look over the trucks once a year, so we're going to continue that regardless.
Yeah.
But if we find out, and we can look into the lab research of, you know, some of that gear oil and some of that stuff outside of like the engine oil, if we can extend the life of that a little bit, it'll save us a little bit on our maintenance costs. Because, well, you can do the math that, what we have, 9 heavy apparatus at $4,000 a pop, that's a pretty good maintenance cost.
Yeah, if you can knock it down 15% or 20% right. percentage, yeah, that adds up. Yeah.
Number 24, unfortunately, the well pump failed at Cottonwood back in January. We had Van Dyke and Drilling come out. They roughly had it back up in 12 hours, I think, but we did have to replace the well pump at the station.
Well, that's probably about right, because it's probably closing in. Has it ever been replaced before? It's probably a 20-year-old pump.
It is, yeah. I believe that station was 2003, 2004.
Yeah, so almost right around 20 years.
Yeah,
not just a couple years after I built my place.
Yeah. Not to my knowledge, it's ever been replaced.
Mm-hmm. So that's about right.
Yeah.
Did they go with the same one, or did they switch to a composite pressure system, or?
I think they just switched it with the same pump that was in there.
Yeah. I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Cool.
So that's good that Storney's standing behind there.
They're sticking with it. Yeah, they didn't even really ask questions. They paid it right up front, so. As long as that keeps up.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that's going to be the, because that was the one that was most affected, right?
That was the one that, yeah, we actually found the problem on. That right. was running rough.
It was running rough and everything, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so with the gas in it, it probably did run a little hot for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they said they'd commit to the life of the truck if it's tied to that issue, that motor replacement, whatever it ends up being, that they'll cover it.
So, going back to staffing and so on, I know we had a discussion a little bit. That's something, again, we're going to bring up here in another meeting or two.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have a proposal that will hopefully kind of address several of these components then. Is that kind of what we're shooting for? Or?
Yeah. It will help. You know, the command staffing to me is my kind of biggest concern right now. I don't necessarily like to see that our residency is dropping and the interest isn't staying up. But if we struggle to have that command staff on, that's such a vital piece of our operations that that's going to have some pretty significant impacts. And yeah, even, you know, what the proposals we'll bring forward into this next fiscal year, it's only beefing up kind of the daytime staffing. But there are options going forward for looking at doing things at night, which we going forward may have to do.
With the paid staff component.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think, and I would agree with what you're saying in terms of hierarchy. I mean, obviously, we want to have all of our bases covered, but in terms of hierarchy of needs, it seems like that command staffing mm-hmm. would be something that obviously would be of a higher priority.
Yeah.
That hierarchy, and yeah, getting that, because that affects recruitment and everything else,
right.
And maintenance of the volunteers. You know, if you don't have good command staffing, you've got a problem all the way down the pipeline.
Yep. And it's something, I mean, have to keep our pulse on as we're getting busier. Like, mm-hmm. we've noticed in the past 5 years, we're up to 30% on our call volume. And that's just 30% more of what our volunteers have to do. And it's just stuff we're just going to have to look at going forward. You know, a lot of departments around the state say that that's kind of when it hits that issue of running with volunteers is now we are already a little bit ahead of the game that we have a paid staff supporting volunteers. We're not fully volunteer, but generally that's 700 to 800 calls a year is when things start to kind of hit a point mm-hmm. where it it becomes an issue.
Where you actually have to look at paid command staffing.
Yeah, or just more of that paid staff model.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess as long as it's not paid, you know, all administrative, you know, it has to be boots on the ground.
Right.
Call type staffing, yeah. Probably going to have to look at that sort of thing in the future.
Yeah. And I mean, even the admin position, I mean, myself and Chris, I mean, we're still going on calls. Yeah.
And I think that's an important part of getting that trend. You know, when you start approaching that call volume that you're talking about, you know, that has to be part of it.
That
it just makes sense at that level. That there would be those responsibilities for administrative staff to be involved in boots on the ground activities.
And I've worked with Amy Christensen, who I'm using as a personnel attorney, to see what options there are with our paid staff, and it's pretty limited, just because of state federal law.
Right.
40 hours of work.
Right. So just again, when the hybrid between volunteer and partially paid, partially volunteer, you basically, the law does not allow for that type of activity. Is that,
I mean, we just looked at different potential options, right, of doing like paid staff on call at night, you know, on a quarter time or half time basis, something like that. And really that there's no law that allows that outside. The only way you can get to there is with a collective bargaining unit, which you have to be unionized to do that.
So they can't get paid overtime?
You can pay them overtime, yeah. That just gets really expensive when you're paying time and a half. Yeah, I mean, technically, well, yeah. We could get pushback of mandating overtime. I mean, if everybody did one command shift a week at night, that'd be an additional 12 hours on top of their 40-hour work week.
But if you're doing that, then you're moving into where you could almost pay for a full-time person instead of four shifts or whatever, however many shifts it would cover.
Yeah, when you start adding up all that overtime. That
It's not quite 50%, but it's up there.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You start approaching another full paid position.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, no, it'll be an interesting discussion, yes. I think that's something we definitely have to have on our radar future. Thinking in terms of timeline, we're talking about your proposal for that type of thing. We were talking about in April-ish?
Yep, I mean, when we start doing preliminary, Amy's already pulled the numbers for us for another full-time employee. And I'm working on the proposal now of what that person would actually do for a job description.
Great. Yeah, I think that'll be a good discussion.
Yep. Yeah, the biggest thing is just staying on top of it and not all of a sudden hitting a brick wall to say, you know, we can't keep going, you know, or, you know, it's just staying on top of this. I mean, Chris and I have been, and Chris has been doing a lot of filling in the gaps with that command coverage. But I just worry that the more that kind of continues, you just start burning out, and that kind of can become an issue.
Accelerate, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So are you guys doing overtime right now?
So Chris and I don't get overtime because we're exempt employees. We can earn comp time. Which is capped, and then we don't get paid out if we leave.
Okay.
For our non-exempt, which are Colin and Mac, they're non-exempt, so anything over 40 hours a week. We encourage them or ask them to take comp time, but legally they can, if they're working over 40, they can request it as overtime.
Okay. And then out of curiosity, do you know, so once we start looking at, you know, 70% fully staffed call and so on, is there at some point, does that affect ISO ratings, the call response, or does that go?
No, ISO ISO is more looking at like station staffing hours and mutual aid or auto aid responses. So they're not necessarily identifying like a call by call staffing It's more just kind of a general of, they're looking at like response times and models. So are we getting out at the door according to NFPA standards, which we're well within. But yeah, I don't know that saying, you know, ideally, and that ideal model is something we've built ourselves. So it's not based off of a ISO rating schedule or anything like that.
What's our rating right now?
We're a 4, ISO 4.
Which is comparable.
Yeah, the city of Bozeman's a 3.
Because they have fire hydrants.
They have fire hydrants and they have a full-time staff. But yeah, water supply is a big part of ISO. There's areas, like I think Central Valley, I think has a dual rating for their hydranted areas versus their non-hydranted areas, just because they have such a big area out by Reese Creek and those further outlying areas. And then, I mean, we're fortunate as Highlight that we have a fire station within 5 miles of everything. And there's some areas that don't have that. And if for ISO, if you're 5 miles out and you don't have a fire station, you automatically are a 10, which is essentially no fire protection.
So that's a big component then.
It's a big
station location.
Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Yep.
Well, thank you. That was a nice long report.
Yeah, I like the detail. I mean, I don't know, it's a lot of work, but I think having that detail in there kind of, you know, if we have a big agenda, we don't necessarily have to talk about it, but to have that written down and be able to kind of digest it, you know, for future discussion on topics like staffing and that sort of thing, I think it's well done, and I appreciate the effort.
Yep.
Yep. It's all part of the plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Sure.
Any trustee activities?
I just wanted to report that both Pete Gaitis and Walt Zydek filed for their candidacy for a trustee position. Thank you very much. And the write-in deadline is February 26th. So after that date, the county will let me know if, or let us know if we need to do an election.
But we didn't have any other
filings. No other filings, just we're just waiting for the write-in. Yeah.
Nice. Cool. Any other announcements? Okay, next board meeting.
It would be on the 21st.
Mm-hmm. March 21st. Don't know how everybody else is good on it, but I'm good on it.
I'm sorry?
March 21st.
And that's also when we got it.
Our next board meeting.
Yeah, I think it's the same day.
What did you say you will be doing?
I'll be good.
That's what I have on my calendar, I'm assuming.
It's Brittany's birthday.
Is it?
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Cool. All right, let's adjourn it. Thank you, everybody.